This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Pleasure to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
So Brent just returned from northern Israel, where he posted a video report of a military exchange this week between Israel and Iran, the latest escalation of the rising conflict between these two Middle Eastern powers. Go to thetrumpet.com, check that video out. It's a very good report. And now he's here to tell us more about it. Nice job on that, Brent.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So tell us what you saw up there.
Well, I was actually going up just for a quick couple day vacation to the north of Israel, but while I was there on the Golan Heights, I figured that I really need to do a video from location, because you can see the Mount Hermon in the distance behind me. And that was the location of an attempted strike by Iran at Israel. For the first time, I think Iran fired one of their precise missiles at Israel, ballistic missiles from Syria. And they were trying to hit a populated area. There were thousands of skiers up on the Mount Hermon slopes. And they fired one of these missiles at Israel on Sunday. And this, as I said, it hasn't been done before. This could have been packing a payload of up to a couple of tons, I actually read today. That changes my story even, I said, from the other couple of days ago, because I said it was about 200 kilograms. But more intelligence has come out, and it was a far larger weapon. And so this would have caused catastrophic damage to Israel. A lot of lives would have been lost. But instead, as you can see from footage, even in the video that we posted, Israel had its Iron Dome defensive missile shield already there below Mount Hermon, and it actually intercepted this missile before it landed in Israel. And so there's a couple of really interesting facets to this exchange. One, this wasn't an exchange between an Iranian proxy, be it Hezbollah, Hamas, or a Shiite militia inside Syria and Israel. This was a launch by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps themselves, acting inside Syria. It was launched from just outside Damascus. It actually followed a bit of an Israeli action on the Damascus airport against Iranian targets. And it's kind of like right now reporting comes in that Israel knew that Iran was planning this precision strike. Qassem Soleimani, the head of the Quds force, he reports directly to the Ayatollah himself. He was in Damascus a couple of days before this strike to arrange it. And Israel, it seems, knew about it, and that's why they had moved their Iron Dome system there. And then Israel kind of provoked this attack, it seems, by taking out some Iranian facilities at the Damascus airport. And then Iran launches this game-changing missile at Israel. Israel destroys the missile, then uses that as its rationale to go and strike a lot of Iranian targets inside Syria. And then basically told the Syrians, don't interfere, we're going after Iran. And then Syria interfered, and they tried to destroy Israel's jets. And so Israel started attacking Syrian installations as well. So a huge back and forth over the north of Israel. But really, it's predicated on the fact that Iran is ready to launch these precision-guided missiles that have a payload that Hezbollah's don't, or that Hamas's don't, at Israeli population centers.
So what do you make of this, Brent? This really seems like we're entering a new phase of this conflict between these two.
It does. I can see it going two ways. I can see Iran continuing to launch such missiles at Israel, and maybe motivating its proxies in Gaza and also in southern Lebanon as well for maybe a three-fronted war against Israel. That's certainly possible. You could also see I know, just looking at this strategically, the Syrian regime kind of get a little bit more and more irked at Iran trying to use its land as a base to attack Israel, because the Syrians are on the receiving end of this. We can't forget that before the Islamic State and before Iran Shiites were involved heavily inside Syria. Yes, Syria was an Iranian ally, but Syria itself had a largely peaceful, if I can put it that in quotes, relationship with Israel. The Golan Heights, the Syrian-Israeli border on the Golan Heights, was one of the most peaceful borders for the past 20 or 30 years. There hasn't been much action at all there. And while Israel didn't like the way that the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad ruled, they were happy to leave him in power, I guess, because that was the devil that they knew. They understood his tactics. They understood his policy. Don't hit us. We won't hit you. We can go about our own business. And now that has changed. That has changed because you've got a full frontal Iranian presence, belligerent presence inside Syria that wants to use that as a staging ground for its ongoing war against Israel. And so, you know, the Syrian regime really does have two choices, what it's going to do going forward. Now, Iran was apparently furious at the Russians over this, because the Russians are there, obviously. They have their anti-missile defensive shield, the Russian one, inside Syria. But the Russians refused to activate it on this. They could have stopped a lot of the Israeli attack on Syrian and Iranian installations, but they did not do it. Because they see it too, Iran's actions against Israel, as being something that can jeopardize Russia's future inside Syria. And so,
again, we see daylight between Russia and Iran.
Yeah, we've talked about that as well. And that prophecy indicates that there's going to be daylight eventually between Syria and Iran. So I could see Iran, you know, in the short term, I think we're going to see Iran not back away from its investment in Syria. They've invested over the past 8 years in Syria $4 billion a year to try and insert itself into that region and put its own proxies there, and even the IRGC getting embedded there. And so they're not going to turn away from this strategy too easy. And I think it's going to take a lot of Israeli response and Israeli action to stop them. So yes, short term, this could be a very dangerous situation for Israel, looking at it with Iran, if they're going to fire these precision missiles at them. Long term, though, Bible prophecy indicates that Iran and Syria are going to have a divorce. They are going to fall out. And perhaps it's the fact that Syria keeps on getting on the receiving end of Iran's belligerence. Bashar al-Assad isn't, while he is an Iranian ally, he is not, he doesn't follow the same tenets of Islam as the crazed Islamic regime in Iran. And so while he's happy to receive funds and cash and weapons from them, he doesn't want to see this. He doesn't want to see Iran use Syria as a staging ground for their genocidal ambitions on Israel, because it would mean the destruction of his own nation and his own rule. And so, looking at this strategically, we can see ways forward where the biblical prophecies can be fulfilled, especially this one related to Syria falling out of the hand of the Iranians and falling into or looking westward, northwestward, for an alliance with Europe instead. And you can go ahead and read our article that we recently wrote entitled The Imminent Syria-Iran Divorce. In that, it talks about the Bible prophecies that back this forecast, how Psalm 83 talks about Iran. Well, it talks about Syria being in alliance with Europe and other anti-Iranian states. And so when we see Iran pushing too hard the Syrians in this way, I mean, it seems that prophecy is getting very much closer to being fulfilled.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. We will move on now. A remarkable power struggle has unfolded this week in the South American socialist nation of Venezuela that has some far-reaching implications. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, street protests have broken out across Venezuela, some of the biggest protests they've had in over a year. The leader of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, has proclaimed himself the legitimate president of Venezuela only 2 weeks after the incumbent president, Nicolas Maduro, was sworn in for his second term. Maduro was actually elected last May. He was just sworn in. But the election was undoubtedly a rigged election. He's basically running a dictatorship there. So the leader of the National Assembly has declared himself the interim president until free and fair elections can be held. Normally, in a case like that, Maduro would just have him arrested. But in this case, with the protest, he has enough street backing to keep himself safe so far. Plus, he's gotten the backing of some very powerful international allies. U.S. President Donald Trump has recognized Guaido as the legitimate Venezuelan president. So has the president of Brazil and most nations across the European Union. On the other side, Maduro is being backed by his own military, of course, but also by Russia, China, and Turkey, and Cuba, as of course, is actually, there's quite a bit of overlap between his military and the Cuban military.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost shaping up to be like a proxy war where you have two presidents in Venezuela, one supported by street protesters, one supported by the military. The new one with the backing of the street protesters, backed by the European Union, some more conservative nations across South America and the United States, with the other one being backed by Russia, China, Turkey, and regimes of that ilk.
Very unusual situation. So looking at this from a prophetic perspective, how we would expect this to play out just based on what's happening there, what do you foresee?
Right. Well, it's definitely interesting timing. We are just getting ready. We may have just actually sent the next issue of the print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet to press.
Mm-hmm.
And our editor, Mr. Gerald Fleury, the title of that article is America is Being Besieged Economically.
Mm-hmm.
Same title for his Key of David television broadcast last week, where it's really highlighting some powerful statements the late Herbert W. Armstrong made about Catholicism being the glue that binds Europe and Latin America together, and then talking about these Bible prophecies in Hosea and Micah and Isaiah and other chapters about a combined European force that comes against America. And so he's talking about like Europe and Latin America teaming up against the United States. Now, right now, these nations in Venezuela is very closely allied with Russia and China. If this new Juan Guaido gets into office, that will swing the political alignment back over to aligned with Europe,
mm-hmm.
and actually the United States as well.
Mm.
So it's definitely a step in a direction towards what this editorial is been predicting based on Bible prophecy,
mm-hmm.
that the many Latin American nations like Brazil has already, or like Venezuela may be doing now, will become much more closely allied with the European Union.
But right. That Trumpet article and that program really focused quite a bit on what has happened in Brazil with the new president taking over there, who's much more ideologically aligned with Europe than with China, and is moving Brazil in that direction. So it could be quite remarkable if we see a similar type of swing take place within this other huge major nation within South America, Venezuela.
Right, and it probably the Venezuelan thing wouldn't have even be happening if it wasn't for the Brazilian realignment already happening,
mm-hmm.
because President Trump, he's using this new president of Brazil, or not using, but they're allied with Brazil, putting pressure on Venezuela as well, recognizing the new president and pushing the nation in that way, which would be hard to get enough pressure to get him into office if Brazil wasn't on your side. So those stories are very linked,
mm-hmm.
but also, as we've talked about on this program before and is described in Mr. Fleury's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, there is a prophecy in Isaiah 23 about a mart of nations besieging the United States that includes Europe and Latin America, like we just mentioned, but also includes Russia and China,
mm-hmm.
or uses their biblical names of Kittim and Tobolsk and Rosh.
Mm-hmm.
And the book describes the significance of those biblical names. So right now it's looking up as it's like a proxy war between the U.S. and European Union on the one side and Russia and China on the other. It's very likely that it will swing towards the U.S.-EU side to forge that strong relationship with Europe. But at some point in the near future, this combined European-Latin American trade bloc is going to give the U.S. partner in their relationship the boot and bring Russia and China back on board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite a remarkable story when you're looking at it from the standpoint of those prophecies that we've drawn attention to quite a lot over the years. But they're becoming more and more relevant as we're seeing these trade blocks come into fruition, as we see just the way that this is playing out politically in South America and how this really could turn against the United States in a huge way. If I could just put a plug in for this coming print edition of The Trumpet, not only do we have the cover story by Gerald Fleury, America's Besieged Economically, we have an article in there. There's a sidebar by Josue Michels about the alignment taking place between Germany and Brazil specifically. Andrew has written an article about, I think it's called Preparing to Storm America's Castle, that show just how vulnerable the United States is in its southern trade routes through the Gulf of Mexico and out on either side of Cuba. We have an infographic that with a beautiful map of just showing how much of the American trade goes through these choke points down there, and how much, if there were an alignment of the powers the way that the Bible describes, this could have a huge impact, shutting off the majority of U.S. trade if there were alignment between Russia, China, Europe, and South America or Latin American countries. Really important story that takes quite a bit of this coming issue of the Trumpet. We've just sent that off to the printer yesterday, so that should be coming up online very soon. Should be next week. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The new friendship treaty between Germany and France that was announced a couple weeks ago, we spoke about it on this program at that time, it was finalized this week. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, the two leaders met in the city of Aachen to sit down and sign this treaty. And as you said, we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, so I'll focus on it mostly on what's changed since then, what we've learned that is new. One of the big things that came out as the full text of the treaty was published and we're able to see more in detail is there was a bit more of a military focus than we knew when we last talked about this. So there was a lot of emphasis on the two of them working together militarily. One really interesting aspect that got a whole lot of comment from people was, or at least from those that were watching it, it included a mutual defense clause where both promised to come to the defense of the other. And you know, people flagged that as interesting because in theory, there's no need of a mutual defense treaty between Germany and France because they're both part of NATO. And NATO includes a mutual defense treaty. So there were a few people flagging this up and saying, well, does this mean that these powers view that NATO is obsolete, or you know, are they preparing just in case NATO falls apart? They're laying the groundwork for a relationship outside of NATO, which I think is absolutely fascinating given you know everything that we've been looking at and watching with Germany pushing an independent path separate from NATO, separate from the United States.
Right.
So it really underscores that these two, you know, like we mentioned last time on the show, when they signed this treaty 50 years ago, it was founded on a relationship with the United States. This time, they're moving hard and fast away from that.
So they're focusing on this defense clause and this mutual defense clause. Any other details about just the military aspect of this that you said has only been revealed here in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, so this paper commits them to, or the treaty commits them to building a common military culture. So that includes just combining a lot of their discussion about what to do in the future, even working on public opinion together. They signed up to contribute to the creation of a European army. So that was, you know, in black and white on paper. I mean, both leaders have said they want a European army, mm-hmm. but now they've both signed up to a treaty saying we aim to create a European army. So that really puts a lot more of a concrete emphasis on that. There's also talk about the two of them deploying abroad, and so that they can, you know, they've got their Franco-German brigade. They've had that for a while. They've not really used it. So there's more talk in this treaty about the two of them working together to do that, and even working together more on their arms industry. So lots of emphasis on this military cooperation. I thought it was really interesting. Deutsche Welle, they wrote, never before in French history has there been a government so fixated on a partnership with Germany, which just coming, I mean, you plug the most recent issue of the Trumpet print, you know, that last issue that we just got out, that was the, before this one, that was the cover article. Mm-hmm. And it was a whole article with Mr. Fleury really drawing attention to this comment from Emmanuel Macron. We love Germany. France loves Germany. And how France was turning away from America to Germany. And this treaty really does that in a very specific way. And other news organizations like Deutsche Welle are picking up on this. You know, there's something fundamental that's changing now in France's relationship with Germany.
Well, just I guess in line with what you're just saying, maybe you could just talk about the significance of the symbolism surrounding this treaty, being in Aachen and the shared history.
Yeah, again, there's a lot. I think a lot about this treaty was all chosen to be symbolic. There are some people that have been looking at this treaty and said, well, there's maybe not as much substance as we would have expected here. But I really think the focus of a whole lot of this was on the symbolism, was on we really want to show that we're, you know, this is a rebirth of our relationship, and we want to show people what it's going to look like moving forward. You know, it is about marketing and showmanship at mm-hmm. its heart. And so they had this. It was signed in the coronation hall of the Aachen Town Hall, and this the Aachen Town Hall. And this town hall was built using some remnants of a structure that Charlemagne built there. And this coronation hall, well, first of all, Charlemagne is everywhere in that building. It's got a life-size statue of him with a sword in one hand and an orb in the other. Mm-hmm. It's got pictures of all kinds of different Holy Roman emperors. Frederick Barbarossa is there. It's got there's a very exact, comprehensive replica in there of the crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire. This replica was actually made by Kaiser Wilhelm II, you know, the guy who started the First World War, but it's got the regalia of Charlemagne there. Napoleon has a massive picture there. So you've got all of these different Holy Roman Empires. It's a completely irrelevant side note. It's also got a picture of the Earl of Sandwich, the inventor of the sandwich. Somehow he gets to be alongside all of these Holy Roman Emperors. But you've got this European royalty. And then the coronation chamber itself, where they did the signing or the coronation room, that's where the coronation banquets of the Holy Roman Empire were signed. You know, Aachen is such a symbolic location, even though it wasn't the capital of the Holy Roman Empire, you know, in the days of the Habsburgs and you know, going on, and even Otto, you know, after Napoleon, they still would go there for their coronation banquets, and it was held in the same hall where they did this signing. And that's where the Charlemagne Prize is awarded today, in this same coronation hall. So there's so much here that there was another cover article from Trumpet editor-in-chief right. Gerald Fleury going
yeah,
a few
that's
months
October
back.
2018, where he was talking about just how much the Holy Roman Empire has been moved right into the center of the stage in Europe.
Right, and that's exactly what you saw with all of this carefully choreographed symbolism through this whole event. I mean, I don't know if there's anywhere on earth with more pictures of Charlemagne in it. I was kind of doing a visual tour online and going through the museum there, and it's like every room you move in almost, there's another Charlemagne image. So it really was heavy in symbolism with this Holy Roman Emperor here. And you know that's not accidental. They choose these locations very, very carefully.
So the point that Gerald Fleury has been making with this the way that European leaders are showing themselves to be so enamored with that Holy Roman history is, when we look at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, that's exactly what prophecy says is going to happen, that there is going to be a seventh final resurrection of that empire, and we can actually trace each of those resurrections down through the centuries since the very first of those empires that follows the exact pattern spelled out in Bible prophecy that this is what would happen. So here we see France and Germany forging this friendship, treaty with all of that symbolism around it. And it couldn't be more bold of a fulfillment of exactly what we have said and Herbert W. Armstrong said would happen within Europe.
It really is striking. I mean, it's a bold fulfillment of things that Mr. Armstrong was saying decades ago, and at the same time, a bold fulfillment of what Mr. Fleury was writing just a few weeks before they announced that this treaty was going to happen. It ties in to all of those forecasts. I mean, it's exactly... And that's why I think it's such an exciting piece of news. It just really comes... All of those prophecies that we've been making that based on the Bible for years just really come alive in this event of France and Germany signing this treaty in the Hall of Charlemagne, basically.
Well, this does definitely give us a chance to point our listeners back to those landmark articles that Gerald Fleury has written, the cover story of... I guess it was the February 2019 edition, France Rejects America and Empowers Germany, the cover story of the October 2018 edition, The Holy Roman Empire Goes Public Big Time. And I'll put a plug in for your book, the one that you contributed to, Richard, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, goes right through the history, links it up with the prophecies of the Bible, and shows how what's happening in Europe today is exactly fulfilling what the Bible said would happen there. We appreciate that very much, Richard. Moving over to Asia, China is making major changes to its military, changes that tell us quite a bit about China's priorities in the world. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China's official Xinhua news agency wrote a feature article about this on Sunday. And it said the People's Liberation Army, or the PLA, is undergoing, quote, transformational changes to downsize the land-based army by nearly half, and then to significantly boost the size of the Navy, the Air Force, the Rocket Force, and the Strategic Support Force. One part of this Xinhua feature says, quote, this new data is unprecedented in the history of the PLA. As a result of the changes, the army now accounts for less than 50% of the total number of PLA troops. End quote. And then it just talks a little bit about how some of those land-based units, especially the non-combat units, were made redundant. And then I think where it gets really interesting is where it talks about where the PLA's focus is now growing and what it's shifting to. This report says this transformational shift means the Chinese military's other four branches, that's the Navy, the Air Force, the Rocket Force, and the Strategic Support Force, which is the branch that focuses on cyber, electronic, and space warfare, those four now comprise more than half of the total PLA. So that's a massive change because the PLA has traditionally been a land-based force, and now it's that accounts for not even half of it. There's also a really interesting bit of analysis here from Ni Lixiong. He's a defense expert based in Shanghai. And he told the South China Morning Post in an interview published on Monday that the overhaul marked a significant strategic shift from having a homeland-based defensive force to one with the capacity to allow Beijing to flex its muscles beyond its national borders and to protect its interests overseas. Mm-hmm. So that's really what this is about. It's a new era for China, with the country's ambitions extending more and more beyond its borders.
Well, we've followed quite a bit the rise of, say, the Chinese Navy, for sure. We've talked about the increase in its activities in terms of cyber warfare. And we've talked even about just some of the advancements that it's made in its space warfare capabilities. So these changes have already been taking place over quite some time. Now we're talking about essentially, it seems like, China redistributing some of its resources away from those other areas in order to accelerate that even more, at freeing up resources in order to make those advancements even more rapidly.
That's right. Yes. This report was interesting in one sense because it sort of said this is now done. You know, it said this has been happening slowly over the last few years, and as of now, the land-based army suddenly accounts for less than half. So it's been happening over a series of years, but it is still ongoing. You know, the dust is still settling a little bit on this.
That's kind of the way that China seems to operate, isn't it? That there are some things that it just doesn't report on,
right.
And it's not until after the fact that we kind of get a full picture.
That's right. Yes, they don't always want to show their full hand until it's over.
So looking at this, these changes, just from a standpoint of what we can expect to see from China going forward, you mentioned moving away from the era where it was essentially a ground-based military to something that really can project force around the world. It seems like we were just talking earlier this week, the Wednesday program, about just how much China is increasing its navy as a means of securing its interests, rapidly expanding interests in several places in the world. It seems like essentially this is the same story of what we were talking about earlier.
I think it is. Really the significance of this is largely because it's happening at the same time as several other major developments in China. You know, China's tightening its control over the South China Sea, one of the most vital shipping lanes in the world there. China's further developing its first overseas military base in the African nation of Djibouti. China's laying the groundwork for establishing a naval base in Pakistan. It's also kind of stealthily building an economic foundation for numerous naval bases in Latin America and around the world. So with this increasing focus on naval power, especially, and the related forces, it just means that Beijing will be very well positioned to defend, to militarize, and to expand these various hubs and interests.
Yeah. And I'm sure that we can expect to see a lot more taking place within the cyber warfare and space warfare arenas as well. Well, if you want more information, do go back and listen to that story from Wednesday's program. Jeremiah talked about the expansion of the Chinese Navy. And anything else that you would point people to for more information, Jeremiah?
Yes, I would also recommend Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's article, China is Steering the World Toward War. In that article, he just really shows why China's rising naval power, not just in the South China Sea, but, you know, beyond everywhere, really, why it should alarm the world, because it does mean that we're headed toward a massive conflict. It's a powerful article, and he explains that it's all based on Bible prophecy and shows how those prophecies are being fulfilled.
All right, very good. Thanks for that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll take a quick look at the anemic state of religion in Britain and at America's infatuation with abortion. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
America and South Korea are having a disagreement over who pays for America's military presence on the Korean Peninsula. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the United States is asking South Korea to start paying quite a bit more money for America to station troops there. It's actually an increase of 40% that the Trump administration is asking for. The U.S. is saying South Korea should now pay $1.2 billion per year for the 28,500 American troops to remain there. And that's up from about $800 million that the South Koreans have paid for the last several years. This is by far the largest monetary increase that the U.S. has ever asked of the South Koreans. And so far, the South Koreans are saying they will not pay it. Hmm. They say they can't go any higher than the figure is $886 million. To keep the U.S. presence as it is. So
it's quite a gap.
Right. Quite a massive gap there. So it really looks like the South Korea-United States Mutual Defense Treaty, which has been just a major pillar of America's power in Asia, it looks like it's under a serious threat.
So why the increase in demands from America?
For the Trump administration, it seems like it's really entirely about the financial aspects of this. In December, President Trump tweeted that the U.S. is, quote, substantially subsidizing the militaries of many very rich countries all over the world, while at the same time these countries take total advantage of the U.S. and our taxpayers on trade. And so there is some truth to that. But right now the U.S. has 28,500 troops, as I mentioned, in South Korea. It also has a THAAD missile defense system deployed there. That's a terminal high-altitude area defense, which positions America to be able to contain potential threats from Russia, China, North Korea.
Right.
Very strategic location for that system. And part of this agreement also says that in the event of a war, America has command over the South Korean military. Mm-hmm. That's the world's 11th most powerful military. So it really boosts America's power in East Asia. So if the South Korea-U.S. Mutual Defense Treaty were to fall apart, it would fundamentally change the whole balance of power in Asia. And there's also the fact that it would undermine the credibility of U.S. security guarantees. You know, I think we'd see Japan and NATO member states, we've already been pressuring them, the Trump administration has, to begin to pay more for their defense, to take on more of that responsibility, to rely less on America. So we could see more of them rushing to leave the guarantees that America has provided. From a purely economic perspective, that would be good for the U.S. in the short term, you know, because it's incredibly expensive for America to have troops and bases around the world and to be the guarantor of world peace.
It reminds me of that article that Andrew wrote in the last print edition, just talking about how much finances could make the difference as to whether or not the United States actually maintains its presence in these places.
Right. Yes. Peace is expensive. And you know, it's very expensive, but the alternative is terrifying. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is maybe something that the Trump administration is, it doesn't seem to see the full picture about. You know, it's very sobering to see America saying it's too expensive and we're willing to pull out of these areas where we've invested so much to keep the peace over the years.
Yeah, I guess in a way it's hard to imagine, say this, you could see these two sides, America and South Korea, trying to find a way to meet in the middle and come up with some kind of a compromise in the short term. But the overall picture, you look at just the fact that America simply cannot afford to maintain this presence in these places. It's got an impossible choice, essentially, that as much as it may even want to maintain that presence, at some point, it's just not tenable.
That's right. There's really not a good, solution to this in the current framework as it is. But the sobering part is who will fill the vacuum,
right?
If the U.S. pulls out of South Korea,
yep,
and other places, because we know who it would be. It's going to be China. It's going to be Russia. It's going to be nations who would not maintain stability around the world.
Yeah. Where would you send people for more information, Jeremiah?
Yes, it's something that fulfills Bible prophecies that we've been watching for decades, really. Bible prophecy clearly says in passages like Leviticus 26:19 that God will break the pride in America's power. We're seeing that fulfilled. We're also seeing a shift underway to what the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. That was the phrase that Christ used in Luke 21:24. And we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that goes through all of these specific Bible passages, and it examines the geopolitical trends that are happening right now, which are fulfilling those prophecies to really show that this tectonic shift is now happening. So I would recommend Russia and China in Prophecy for anyone who wants to understand what's happening here.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Well, we spoke earlier about Israel's conflict with Iran. That isn't the only hot spot Israel is having to deal with. For this, we will go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, Israelis are really worried that things are going to deteriorate fast in the Gaza Strip again. And it has to do with these large sums of money that Hamas is receiving every single month from Qatar. We haven't really spoken about this on the program before, but there was a deal worked out at the end of last year whereby the Qataris would send about $90 million to Hamas via Israel in cash, in suitcases, American dollars, and they would be given $15 million a month in order to keep Gaza afloat, because Hamas, while it is a terrorist organization, it also does run the government itself. And so $10 million of the $15 million was meant to go to just services to keep the place going. And then $5 million would go to Hamas's own employees. And so this has come in for 2 months back in November, December. And then there was a halt in it because of the flare-ups of violence that were taking place. This past week was there another $15 million was meant to be going through of Qatari cash to Hamas. But Israel said it was not going to allow it because there were a couple of shootings on the Gaza Strip with Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorist group there firing against Israelis. And Israel and the government said, well, if you're doing this, we're not going to allow this money to go through. And so then after a couple of days of not allowing the money to go through, Israel said, okay, we'll now let the money go through. And now Hamas has come back and said, we don't need that money. We don't want your money. Get ready for violence.
That's pretty pretty bold statement from Hamas. So how do they propose to keep themselves afloat without that money?
It's we don't know. We don't know how they're going to do that. I mean, they do receive $50 million from Iran a year. They also receive Palestinian Islamic Jihad does as another Hamas proxy, Iranian proxy there. They receive $70 million a year from Iran. So the military wing is going to be able to survive no matter what from this Qatari cash. The question is whether the people themselves will get upset over not receiving this money. Now, it's a difficult scenario to figure out, because if the people don't receive the money, they also get upset and they blame Israel. And right. So then they tend to be more violent towards Israel. And so it's kind of violence any way you have it.
Really the bottom line, that Hamas is kind of standing up for principle. And this suggests that there is going to be an escalation here.
It certainly does. I think what's really interesting on the sidelines to all of this is whether it escalates or not. It is just getting a lot of the Israeli public upset with the Netanyahu government. From politicians, even from the left, from the right, have been really upset by this decision that the government has to, or even allow the Qataris to fund Hamas. When you think about it, there's $15 million of cash every month going to Hamas, and Israel is letting it happen. And the Netanyahu government is letting it happen. And then you have, you know, Israeli civilians right on the border of Gaza that see missiles fly over, and they, you know, they put one and one together and say, right, Israel is funding the missile campaign of Hamas on its own civilians. And while not all this money does go to Hamas for such violent acts, some of it does. And that was the late Israel. We're not letting this cash go across because it's funding the high level Hamas officials, the violent Hamas officials, and we don't want that to happen. And then Hamas said, well, we don't want the money anyway. But what it's really just, you know, we think of the Netanyahu government as being so strong on terrorism, so strong on Iran. And here they are allowing cash to go through to try and buy some quiet. That's what they're doing it for. Mm-hmm. They're trying to buy a little bit of quiet on the southern front. And it really, really does speak to how intractable this issue is with Gaza and Israel, and how difficult it is for the Netanyahu government to solve. Any other politician comes into power, they won't really have a solution that can work going forward either, I don't think.
Well, that really is a good point, that how does any Israeli politician resolve a situation like this, just trying to work it out on their own? There's really no good solution here.
There isn't at all. And our editor-in-chief has really referred to this quite a lot, the peace process of trying to work with the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank at length, and how there isn't a solution that man is going to come up with to this issue. Israel cannot solve its own problems. And while it might seem trite to just say you need to turn to God for your solution, that is the only solution. I think Israelis over the past
you know, 30 years of the, or coming into 30 years, the peace process going on, that they should be able to see that there is proof that you can have a left-wing government in power, you can have a right-wing government in power, but it is not going to solve the Palestinian issue. And God is really asking the Israeli public right now, I think, to look to him to try and find what those solutions are. And those solutions, they are laid out in our editor-in-chief's book, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Thanks for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll conclude the program today with a couple of stories about the religious and moral state of Britain and America. First, a look at just how weak the Anglican Church has become, especially among younger Brits. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so the Archbishop of Canterbury published an interview with The Spectator this weekend, and it really had some amazing information about his relationship with the Catholic Church. And I think this is just a, I mean, we talked about the last example being story we talked about in Europe, a fantastic example of fulfilled prophecy. This is a fantastic example of a just a really direct prophecy that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about for years. He talked about just how close he is to the Catholic Church. He said, I chat with the Pope quite regularly. We're on good terms with him. This article mentioned the fact, and I found this statistic astounding. 10 years ago, we talked about this a lot at the time, that the Catholic Church changed the rules on people coming in from the Church of England. And there's been this massive flood since then of Church of England vicars going to Rome, to the point now that 1 in 10 Catholic priests in the UK is an ex-Anglican vicar. 1 in 10, it's had a huge input on the church. And so they were talking about this in this interview. As the interviewer, he asked the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Anglican Communion, well, are you worried about this? And he said, well, who cares? I don't mind about that at all, particularly if people go to Rome, which is such a source of inspiration. He talked about he got an email from an Anglican priest who'd gone to Rome, and he said, "That how wonderful." And you know, he talked about how one of his close friends is the Bishop of London, one of the top Catholic representatives. And he even said that 50 years ago, well, he said 50 years ago that this would have been news. He said, Cardinal Nicholls and I would have described each other as very close friends. We see each other regularly. We pray together. We talk together. 50 years ago, this would have been news. And so it's just it shows how much the Church of England has changed over that time. But 50 years ago, there was somebody writing about this news, saying that this would happen. We've got in our booklet, He Was Right, that just provides a fantastic overview of world events and what Herbert W. Armstrong forecast. He has there's a section in there, Returning to the Fold, the chapter's called. And it goes through everything that he was saying and writing about all of these different Christian churches returning to Rome. And a lot of that's built around prophecies in the Bible. In the book of Isaiah, it talks about the Catholic Church saying, well, I won't suffer the loss of daughters. We're going to bring the daughter churches back into Rome. And so based on that prophecy, Mr. Armstrong said, well, just you watch. These different churches, that was in Isaiah 47, these different churches, they're all going to go back to Rome. And like even the Archbishop of Canterbury himself said, at that time, 50 years ago, that was incredible. You know, that was unbelievable. Nobody expected that. It was almost an antagonistic relationship between them. Now you've got the Archbishop of Canterbury saying, well, that's wonderful. We're all practically one church. If you decide to go to Rome, you know, what difference does it make? I listen to the church. I listen to the Pope. I kind of almost view him as my superior. I go to him for advice. I mean, the Church of England, this one of the biggest, most prestigious Protestant churches, they're pretty much back in the fold with the Catholic Church already, just as Herbert W. Armstrong said.
That is quite a story. I wish we had more time to devote to that. There's just a lot to think about there. It's interesting to hear this going on at the same time that we're seeing Brexit take place, where you see this conflict between Britain and the European continent, which is you think of as the Vatican's influence there being quite strong. Prophetically speaking, and here you have just Britain kind of throwing away what has caused it to stand apart from the continent in so many ways over the centuries, as you said, just going along with what Herbert Armstrong said would happen based on those prophecies in Isaiah. Stephen Fleury talked about this on his radio show yesterday. You can go to, the title of that program is A New Level of Depravity. It's about 31 minutes in, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Our last story, getting an abortion in New York just got a whole lot easier. For this, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, with the upcoming potential of overturning the Roe versus Wade legislation, now we have five conservative Supreme Court justices with a possible six being appointed in the next few years, states are working to try to protect their abortion rights. Now, for those who aren't familiar with Roe versus Wade, this is the federal Supreme Court decision that abortion has to be legal in every state. If you overturn it, it's now up to the states. But this is a prime example of how you can't legislate morality, in that if the culture is prioritizing abortion or the people want to prioritize abortion, you could easily just have all 50 states pass state-level laws legalizing abortion and not even need the federal protections for or against it. That probably won't happen. It looks like there's many conservative states like Texas and others that if Roe versus Wade would overturn, which would love to make abortion illegal. But New York is definitely taking steps, having passed this week the Reproductive Health Act via a vote of 38-42, which legalizes abortion up to 24 weeks. That's about 6 months, so up till the end of the second trimester, or even all the way up to birth, if they're, the doctor says he thinks the mother's health could be hurt in any way by childbirth.
Which could mean anything.
Right. That's one of those things where a lot of people be like, oh, yeah, we need to abort if the mother's health is going to be hurt, but it's a think it's childbirth is not great for your health in any circumstance, but it's
Or they could say, well, her mental health, or they could define that however they want. The law is very very ambiguous about it.
Right. And so this is just showing the societal movement, whether or not Roe versus Wade is overturned, abortion is becoming more and more prevalent in America. The statistics show that in New York City, where this law was passed, it's actually already up to 1 in 3 pregnancies is aborted. So one of the higher rates in the nation. And we can put an article in the show notes by Mr. Fred Dadlow entitled "Is Abortion Really Murder?" that delves into the Christian living aspect of this, showing. Not so much the legal entails of what the Constitution or Roe versus Wade allows, but just the moral aspect of what the Bible has to say about killing a human being before they're born.
At one time it seemed like the Democratic Party, I think about Hillary Clinton talking about the fact that she wanted abortion to be legal, but safe, legal, and rare, that she was focusing on the fact that it was something that nobody felt like should be encouraged. But Stephen Fleury was talking about this on yesterday's program, the same show that he was talking actually about the Anglican Church, where he was talking about how much in abortion clinics they are encouraging people to get abortions, that there's a business side of it, and they're trying to make as much money as they can at this. We really seem to have descended much further away from even the very liberal standard that was being promulgated just a decade or so ago, to something where it's almost it's actually being actively encouraged.
Right. Yeah, that's I guess that's true of the especially the Democratic Party in general, where even, like I said, when Hillary Clinton in the early 1990s, where they're saying, like, well, we need to grant amnesty to illegal immigrants, but crack down on border security so no more come. Mm-hmm. And we need to allow abortions in cases where, like, rape or incest or the mother's health, life's in danger, but not encourage it. Mm-hmm. And now it's just full out kill your babies and replace them with people from Latin America.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the party has become radicalized, as has society in general, moved much more toward in that direction. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and you can get links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today. A lot of material that you can sink your teeth into. If you want more information about what we talked about, you can email your thoughts about the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Real honor to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Seneca: as the soil, however rich it may be, cannot be productive without culture, so the mind without cultivation can never produce good fruit. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.